Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today are Cynical regulars Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind the inimitable Danway.org. How are you, Jeremy?
Good evening, Kaiser.
And Will Moss, who chronicles his life as an American spin doctor in China on the blog Image Thief. Welcome back, Will.
How are you, Kaiser?
I'm great, man. How are you?
Good.
So, next week, we've got Stephanie Kleiner-Albrandt, who originally was going to come on the show this time. She's from International Crisis Group, as well as Kathleen McLaughlin from the Bureau of National Affairs, and another special guest to be named with a podcast focused on foreign policy issues, including North Korea Revisited, and the talks that took place this week between China and India on their longstanding border issues. But today, like everyone else in the world, we're still focused on the embattled WikiLeaks and its release of diplomatic cables. We're going to focus, of course, on the cables that came out of the U.S. Embassy here in Beijing, and particularly on what Xi Jinping's tastes in movies will actually tell us about the intimate politics of Zhongnanhai. We'll also talk about China's lobbying efforts surrounding the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony, and we'll chat a bit about the Confucius Peace Prize, a sort of alternative bizarro world prize where the winner apparently was none other than Lian Zhan of Taiwan, the sort of pro-mainland-leaning Taiwan politician, with an interesting range of other nominees thrown in from Bill Gates to Jimmy Carter to Beijing's officially recognized Panchen Lama. After that, we're going to talk about the case of Zhao Lianhai, the activist father of a child made ill by melamine-tainted milk, who was sentenced to a 2.5-year term by a Chinese court. It now looks as though Hong Kong members of the CPPCC, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, God, I hate saying that, lobbied hard enough.
And we hate hearing you say it.
You do. So anyway, these guys lobbied against the sentence, took out some ads in newspapers, and managed to get him released on medical parole, according to the Financial Times. And finally, we're going to look at the China Daily online editor's picks for the top 10 celebs of 2010, which is, I think you gentlemen will agree, a very strange list.
I think the question that is in both Jeremy and my mind is, are you on that list? And if not, why not?
You're right, man. I think I was just like squeezed off by the little person.
I think that Julian Assange squeezed you off.
A note on the pronunciation of this man's name. Which no one seems to know.
Well, there was – it was written up – we were just looking this up before the show. It was written up in the recent New Yorker profile of him, which appears to have come out about 2 months early, unfortunately for them. Thus, the name Asang – and I'm saying it with a hard G – the name Asang is thought to derive from Asang or Mr. Sang, a Chinese emigre who settled off the coast of Australia in the early 1800s and whose descendants later moved to the continent.
Well, and his Chinese – the way that his name is being written in Chinese is Asangqi, and the Sang is Sang Shu the Sang. It's a mulberry tree, which is in fact a Chinese surname. So his ancestor may well have been Xing Sang. Yeah.
So we've settled that once and for all.
We have. So Asang and more WikiLeaks from this gentleman who now is incarcerated in a prison in the UK. So last week in our double edition, we covered some of the materials from the WikiLeaks pile about North Korea, about Kyrgyzstan, about Vice Foreign Minister Wu Dawei and so on. But finally, we've got a little more to work with. They've released a second batch, including the one that we were griping about not having seen in actuality, the Google hacking cable, for instance. So let's start off with that one, this Google hacking cable release. How well is this thing sourced? I mean, it makes – let's just review. The allegation essentially is that none other than the Politburo member who's in charge of propaganda, Li Changchun, was Googling himself, is that correct?
Yeah.
Googling himself and finding material that he thought to be less than flattering, and sort of orchestrated this what came to be known as Operation Aurora, this attack on Google. How well are these things sourced?
Well, a lot of these stories sound to me like typical Beijing xiaodao xiaoji, just the rumor and gossip of the small streets and of the alleyways, the hutongs. I'd be a rich man if I had a dollar for every time I've heard somebody describe an act of censorship in China being caused by some fuddy-duddy old official suddenly being shown a website by his grandson freaking out and then ordering the entire country to censor a magazine or a website. So I'm not too sure if one should take the allegations about Li Changchun Googling himself too seriously. The allegation that it was directed by the Politburo, I don't know if one should take any more seriously, although it does, it's one more story suggesting that internet censorship is something that is taken to the very highest level in
that
China.
I don't doubt for a moment, though.
So it's not really anything new, you know.
Yeah, I have a very hard time believing that the Standing Committee are spending a lot of time Googling themselves. You know, if you want to look for the conspiracy theory in this, it seems much more credible to me that somebody on his staff Googled him and said, oh my God, if the boss ever sees this, you know, it's going to hit the fan. But there are so many reasons for the government here to have had concerns about Google. And Google was contentious for so long that I think it's, you know, you don't have to look for those kind of theories to find reasons why this might have happened.
I also think that there is a sort of generation gap which one sees all over the world. I've had the experience a few times of somebody calling me up and saying, Jeremy, I have a question to ask you. You know, there's this blog which writes about XXX in my industry or something I'm interested in. And this guy, he just wrote these things about me and he criticized me. And, you know, then there are these people in the comments are agreeing with him. And what do I do about it? And I have to say, you know, start your own blog or, you know, ignore it. You know, there is something I can imagine a situation like that happening. I mean, the source could be a well-placed source with a real story, and it could equally just be typical Beijing gossip.
So another Politburo member, Li Keqiang, who is sort of slated to be the number two man, apparently does not trust the official GDP numbers if the diplomatic cable's sources are to be believed. What's up with that, Jeremy?
Well, he sounds like a very reasonable man. I mean, in the cable, he basically says, look, the GDP numbers are man-made, so they're not to be trusted. And he tends to prefer measurements such as electricity consumption, which is what, as I understand, most serious economists and investment bankers who want to really understand what's going on in China also do.
So he's sensible, reasonable, and actually understands how to get some usable data.
Exactly. So what a sensible man. You know, great. Go, Li Keqiang.
That's probably a good sign, actually.
It's a very good sign.
But I have some thought that those guys are getting their hands on real information. I don't think this is the first time that the center has raised doubts about some of the figures that are coming in from the periphery. And in a way, it's probably reassuring to know that they are as skeptical of some of this information as overseas analysts.
Not believing their own PR.
It's just gratifying for us to know that when Li Keqiang looks at a China Daily headline talking
he takes
about
it with
GDP,
a grain of salt.
He laughs the same as we do. That's very gratifying.
Good. Appropriate chuckling is good. The one that I thought was probably the most interesting was this sort of in-depth analysis of so-called factional politics within the Chinese leadership, looking at the princelings. And I can't remember his name for the shopkeepers.
The shopkeepers.
Shopkeepers' sons, right, which I think refers, of course, to the Communist Youth League faction, the people who don't have sort of the blue blood revolutionary roots.
They're not true princelings because princeling, this term, is misused in the Western media to just mean anybody who's well connected. A true princeling is a child of the first generation of communist leaders,
right.
The child
Marsh.
Of revolutionaries.
Right.
That's a princeling. If your father, or I don't think there are many cases of mother, but if your father is not a revolutionary, you're not a princeling.
Right. So this particular source, I thought, was interesting in that he dismissed this idea that there's, in fact, a reform faction and described the leadership there as essentially just self-interested, interested primarily in promoting their own cliques, their own clans, their own family, and, of course, working toward the preservation of the party in power.
And this comes as absolutely no surprise to me. This jibes with every experience I've ever had with the Chinese government.
Which leads me to it seems that the WikiLeaks cables show, at least to me, that our diplomatic corps isn't all that off the mark. That they're actually getting some decent information. That
Well, it's. I guess it depends what your expectations are. And people have looked at the cables that have been released, which is so far only a very, very small fraction of the total. It's less than 1,000 out of, you know, a quarter million.
250,000, yeah.
And drawn various conclusions about our, you know, our diplomats and the strength of our Foreign Service officers. I think you have to sort of look at the context of these things, and they're part of a blizzard of regular ongoing communication, sometimes about very anodyne stuff and sort of day-to-day observations. I think what you can see is that the diplomats here and around the world are, you know, trying to pay attention to things and trying to send their observations back to the center. And I think, like many of us, they're looking for any insight and any information they can glean. And a lot of the time they're getting the same things we are, from what I can see. One of the great reactions to these cables is that there haven't been vast surprises. And, you know, unless something changes dramatically as more of them are released, then...
Yeah, I think they probably culled through enough of them so that we would have seen, I mean, any gigantic...
Has there been any bombshell?
I don't believe so.
I mean, there have been some sort of interesting insights and glimpses of personality. But mostly what there has been, you know, and the reason why I think... You know, the American government was embarrassed. Is what there was in the cables was candor about things that people already understood, or that was reported elsewhere, but that hadn't been stated publicly.
Look, there are some long-term effects that we don't know how they'll turn out. For example, the cable we were just discussing, which was basically talking about how interest groups are what's controlling China, and there's no reform wing. In that cable, it also the source. Specifically names various people who control various interest groups, like the much despised former premier Li Peng is named, for example, as
electricity.
His family controls electricity in China. Now, these things are on the record, and despite Joe Lieberman's best efforts, they're going to stay on the internet for good. They're in the public domain. The next time, for example, a journalist does a story about Li Peng or the electricity industry in China, they'll have access to this information and they'll quote it. So some things, I think, will take a few years possibly to see what the ultimate ramifications of these cables are, even if they don't seem particularly surprising now.
I think you're right.
I think that's a good point.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And with that, let's move to the most important of the cables, which was the one that detailed Xi Jinping, the anointed heir, and his taste in film. I was very shocked by this.
Well, I think this is, of course, exactly the kind of information we were looking for from these things. That's the real nitty-gritty information and the window into how things work.
So Xi Jinping likes Saving Private Ryan and hates the works of Zhang Yimou.
So
I have something in common with him.
Well,
not the early works, I hope.
Not the early works.
But the early stuff was great, man.
But so wait, who is questioning official statistics? That was Li Keqiang. Okay, yeah.
But Xi Jinping is
pretty promising, actually.
Right? He doesn't like these sort of costume drama, palace intrigue, high flying kung fu movies, The Curse of the Golden Flower.
They're tedious.
And this, I have to say, gives me even more hope that with Xi Jinping we will have a return to some personality on the Chinese political scene. These remarks about the movies, combined with his classic remark, where he was saying, you know, their foreigners have eaten their fill and have nothing to do pointing their fingers at China, which I kind of had quite a strong sneaking sympathy with. And the fact that his wife is a famous folk singer, Peng Liyuan, whose works you will be familiar with if you watch CCTV any time before about 2007.
That's about right.
And may become the first lady with any charisma China's had since Jiang Qing. I don't know if that's a good thing.
Let's not discuss that.
Exactly. I mean, we can go pretty far back, you know, to the Empress Lu in the Tang, or in the Han Dynasty, or you know.
So he didn't like late stage Zhang Yimou, but he likes Steven Spielberg.
He likes The Departed. he liked that Scorsese flick.
So I
and
guess
it's weird. I'm not even sure he knew it was a remake.
Well, that was the question I was going to ask: is did he prefer it to the Hong Kong version, Infernal Affairs, or not?
Yeah, that's. I'd really. Love did, to
I
know.
Don't think that's it was mentioned. What our in listeners the cable.
Really well, that's see. This is the kind of information our diplomats need to be getting. You know,
the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony is taking place probably the day that this podcast is released, right on Friday. As of today, that's what's today, Wednesday, December the 8th, Beijing appears to have talked about, 18 countries now into publicly stating that they will not attend the ceremony. And what a list it is. Some are not a big surprise. Some of them look like they sort of belong on in the rogues gallery of nations. But there are some that have been sort of nation built by the good old US of A, including Afghanistan and Iraq, that will not attend. Nor will Saudi Arabia, whose oil interests we were presumably defending when we went into the Gulf in the first place. What does this say? I've seen the Telegraph, for example, talked about how this is a sign of the decline of American influence globally. What do we make of this list? And is this something that the Chinese Foreign Ministry can point to as a success, or is it an abject failure? They had talked about 100 or more countries that wouldn't be attending, and the list is rather more paltry.
I don't think the countries not attending are doing anything to increase China's soft power, I have to be honest. You know, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq refusing to attend, Russia refusing to attend. In terms of the Nobel Prize giving China a bad reputation for human rights, the absence of those countries is not going to change anything.
Sure. Yeah, and all these folks are not exactly known for their sterling records on human rights either. Rather more interestingly, the Associated Press today came out with a piece by Tini Tran talking about this Confucius Peace Prize. Can you tell us the backstory of the whole Confucius Peace Prize thing, Jeremy?
It seems to be like the Harmony Prize, which we recently discussed.
That's a favorite of ours here on the show.
It is.
We're still hoping.
And we're still waiting for Frank Liu, the impresario of the Harmony Prize, to call us and up his bid for the Seneca.
But now we've got the chairman of the awards committee, Tan Chang Liu, who could presumably be another buyer for Seneca, right?
Well, it seems so. And it seems to be another private initiative. It doesn't seem to have state support. And there was, as far as I could tell, no coverage of this in the state-owned media today.
Yeah, that was interesting. No mention of it.
But a Peace Prize, Confucius Peace Prize, alternative to the Nobel, and it's going to go to Lian Zhan, the Taiwanese, mainland-born Taiwanese politician. It's quite funny. I think judging at least from my Twitter feed today, there's not a single journalist who writes about China who didn't laugh out loud at the idea.
Yeah. It should be pointed out maybe also for the benefit of the non-news junkies listening that Lian Zhan is an ex-chairman of the Kuomintang on Taiwan and like a longtime friend of, he's one of the conciliatory
one of the people
voices.
Who's been building bridges with the Communist Party for a long time. It is. But, the stupid thing is that, this and the Harmony Prize do China no favors because they just come off to everybody, Chinese included, as a shanzhai ban, a cheap imitation of the Nobel Peace Prize. And nobody's going to take them seriously. I would actually think there is a place in the world for some kind of peace prize that is viewed from a more Chinese point of view, where somebody like Lian Zhan would get it.
They're saying this was hastily cobbled together.
It's just a cheap ripoff.
It's hastily cobbled together. The combination of the unseemly haste, the timing, and the choice of honoree, all of those actually serve to dilute any credibility that it might otherwise have.
Let's talk about some of the other nominees for it. We had Bill Gates, of course. That's sort of a standard hero to a lot of people here in China. We have Jimmy Carter. I think he's been nominated for every Peace Prize that's ever been created.
Mandela, you could say more or less the same thing.
Right.
Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, Mandela, of course. And then there was the Panchen Lama, which I think was sort of a jab at the 89 prize that went to the Dalai Lama, the Nobel Committee. So this was obviously sort of You know, the choice was very deliberate.
A very comprehensively thought out Shanzhai Peace Prize.
It reminds me of nothing more. I mean, because I think that it really does lack official support. I mean, this guy claims that they work closely with the Ministry of Culture, which doesn't seem like it would be the right ministry to work with.
I work closely with the Ministry of Culture.
I'll nominate
where's
you
your
next
where's
year.
Your Peace Prize then?
But it reminds me of back in the early 90s and in the late 90s, in fact. A lot of my rocker friends were indignant about the constant browbeating that Beijing was always receiving over over issues about Tibet from various American rights groups and so forth. They kept saying, "Kaiser, let's stage a free Hawaii concert, or let's stage a free the Native American Indians concert." I mean, it's sort of in the same spirit. I think part of it is sort of trying to point out hypocrisy or mocking or.
Look, I'm with Jeremy in the sense that I think there's an argument to be made for something like the Peace Prize that's less from a Western point of view. To that end, I thought one of the constructive things that could have happened here if the government was unhappy with the Peace Prize would have been for them to say, you know, here's 8 or 10 Chinese people that we think would be great recipients of Nobel Peace Prizes or science prizes or anything. And, you know,
I mean, but
this is
the
a big, big country with
–
well, why – you know, if they want to make a statement about it, this is a big country with a lot of talented, smart, you know, well-intentioned people doing good stuff. And there are probably many, many people – not probably. There are many, many people worth recognizing here. And, I think there's very positive ways you can call attention to them. I don't think a raft of also-ran, privately-backed, weird – prizes to uninspiring recipients is what's going to help. But I do think there are constructive ways to advance positive Chinese global role models.
Now that this is out there, I mean, I think the most positive and constructive thing the Chinese government could officially do is disavow it. I mean, to walk away from it, saying, "Hey, we had nothing to do with this, man. I mean, this is not us. I don't know these guys." That's not going to happen because they're just not that smart, unfortunately. Let's move on to the next topic, to Zhao Lianhai. There was a story that ran just yesterday, or it was today possibly, in the Financial Times by Rahul Jacob out of Hong Kong. He opened the story talking about a Hong Kong businessman, not unlike many others. His name is Liu Manhong, who happens to be a member of, I'm going to do it again, the CPPCC, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference.
Well said.
Who, along with a few others, had taken out a 2-page advertisement in a prominent Chinese or Hong Kong Chinese language newspaper calling on the government to release or at least sort of lighten the sentence of this fellow by the name of Zhao Lianhai. Zhao Lianhai, as I said in the intro earlier, his son or daughter, I'm not sure what it was, a child of his, had been made seriously ill in the melamine crisis.
His son.
It was his son in 2008. We all remember that very well. And he had become an activist since. I think he was officially sentenced for, quote, provoking quarrels and making trouble, a standard by which I think anyone would know Jeremy should long ago have been clapped in irons. I mean, sent away to the gulag. Are you aware of any precedent for this? Private citizens or even CPPCC members?
I can't really remember it coming out of Hong Kong. But I mean, if you know, there have been a lot of cases. I mean, let's just look at like Deng Yuzhao.
Yeah, Deng Yuzhao.
You know, there were some of the famous cases where internet activism has seemed to result in government action.
This is so different, right?
This is a little bit different. It's a Hong Kong. It's a powerful Hong Kong person. But I also think that this particular, food safety, I think, is one of those issues that everybody in China, in the Chinese government, knows that there's not really a lot of tolerance for messing around with it. They have to be very, very careful of imprisoning somebody
That's right.
like this. And if they have interest groups who start motivating against it, it's not a core threat to the party's rule.
It's
so I think there's
clear,
a lot of room for –
There are a few key issues where civil society is apt to coalesce, and one of them is definitely food safety.
It's actually – you know, it's like an easy win for them if they're seen to act positively on it because it's relevant to everybody in the country and it's emotional.
Right. is it possible that these Hong Kong fellers chose their target because it was a fairly easy win?
It's a fairly easy win, but it's also something that everybody can get behind, I think. Whereas, you know, if you, there are other cases where, I mean, you know, let's go back to poor Mr. Liu Xiaobo rotting in jail. And you have, you know, venture capitalists writing the New York Times just today, you know, saying how he shouldn't get the prize and the Communist Party is doing everything right. And, you know, when it comes to somebody who is seeking change to the system, you lose a lot of sympathy from a lot of people, even ordinary Chinese people. Whereas when it comes to something like as basic as food safety, I mean, there's not anybody in China who doesn't want their food to be safer.
And,
there's a lot of people
also,
who don't care.
Especially for, want their kids' food to be safer.
Did you write that venture capitalist's name down? We should hit him up. He might want to buy Seneca.
Maybe he does.
Remember, we are cheap.
They published two editorials. I think in the print edition they were kind of, you know, face-to-face or back-to-back or, you know, however you say. And online it was a little bit more difficult to tell. The one was by this fellow and the other one was by Bao Tong. Basically, one saying, you know, Liu Xiaobo is great and the other one saying the Communist Party is great and if they're doing a great job and if that means the Nobel chair has to be empty, the Nobel Peace Prize chair has to be empty, tough luck because...
Who is this guy? Do you care to out him? What's his name?
Eric Li. According to the New York Times description, he's the founder and managing director of a leading VC firm in Shanghai. He's also a Henry Crown Fellow at the Aspen Institute and a doctoral candidate at Fudan University's School of International Relations and Public Policy. So his article was called A Color Revolution in China, Keep It Red. He may not have written that headline, but it's basically saying that the Communist Party is doing a great job. And if that means sometimes people like Liu Xiaobo will get a Nobel Peace Prize and the chair will be empty, tough luck because the alternative is far worse. The New York Times balanced this, as I said, with another editorial by Bao Tong, the famous reformist politician, ancient guy under house arrest in Beijing, whose article was titled Rights for All Through Peaceful Means in support of Liu Xiaobo. Anyway.
Yeah, I think he's actually with Cheng Wei in Shanghai, which, by the way, is an investor in Youku. Probably not such good timing considering they just went public today. Anyway.
Well, his point of view is, his argument is an argument that I think Charlie Cust on China Geeks actually says himself in a comment on this, that it's an argument he's made in the past to people who don't know much about China about how the government essentially has done a very good job in many ways.
And it has.
And he is arguing that, that is important and therefore we have to not
certainly
worry.
Shouldn't lose sight of it, but nor should we lose – we can go on with that forever. But I'm the most urgent business today is to snicker at this list of the China Daily web editorial team put together a list of the 10 top celebrities of 2010, clearly the most important story of the year. They are –
Why are you snickering? This is a very serious list.
Vladimir Putin, Julian Assange, Kim Jong-un, Warren Buffett, Prince William, Silvio Berlusconi, Aung San Suu Kyi, Anna Chapman, Harriet
Back
Anderson.
Up. You want to explain Anna who Chapman? Anna Chapman is for people who don't remember?
Anna Chapman was that hot redhead Russian spy who was part of that whole, you know, spy ring and...
And there's a very come hither photograph of her attached to the story.
There is. Very, very come hither, yes. Harriet Richardson Ames, who is a centenarian who got a college degree a day before she died. She had put it on her bucket list to finish her college degree and that business done, she could expire and leave the world. And, of course, last but certainly not least, but certainly shortest, Khagendra Thapa, the Nepalese man who Guinness lists as the shortest man in the world, who apparently is now starring in some sort of tourism commercial on behalf of his
on behalf of Nepal.
Himalayan kingdom. Yeah.
Well, you know, I actually like – I give them sort of 8.5, you know. I mean you could make an argument for many of the people on this list that if they're not all globally influential, they are. They were all to some degree about through the first eight at least newsmakers in the year, and then this the centenarian teacher. Well, I mean, on straight Confucian lines, she does pretty well. She's
got
a teacher
age and education.
And she's 100, right?
That's
so she's right there. She's gold.
And
right.
She continued to educate herself until her dying.
Right. I mean,
breath.
What's not to like? Yes. I mean, that's like the role model. Like that is the role model for this country. And so I think they're good, like right up until you get to the tourism ambassador, which to me, and I don't want to sound like I'm prejudicing against short people because I don't think I am, but as a choice for a list of international newsmakers or influential people of the year is maybe, I don't know, that one seems that's borderline.
Exactly. He doesn't have quite the stature of the other ones.
But, you know.
I'm sensing a distinct kind of discriminatory vibe coming off the two of you.
To point out that Jeremy is the shortest person in the room.
Two names, though, that I think jumped out at me as particularly odd choices for a state-run Chinese newspaper were, well, Mr. Assange, of course, Julian Assange, and Aung San Suu Kyi, who was recently released after years of house arrest by the Burmese junta. It's hard for me to see how they can name her without thinking sort of, in the same week that they're
vociferously protesting. But let's bear in mind, this is the China Daily web editors. This reminds me a little of things we used to run on Dangwei.org about, Xinhua, state-owned porn, where the Xinhua website, some web editor would put together a gallery of 10 hottest big breast photos on the internet, and then take scans from FHM and, rather saucy photographs. I mean, it's the same kind of approach to editorial, I think.
And it's the it's the English language edition. Plus, I think by any yardstick, even if, political dissidence is often makes people dyspeptic here, in many ways, it's a pretty non-controversial choice if you're singling out newsmakers, particularly if you're not rendering a political judgment, which I don't think this piece does.
No, it pains not to, right. Let me remind everybody that next week we've got Stephanie Klein-Albrandt from International Crisis Group, Kathleen McLaughlin from the Bureau of National Affairs. If you're listening, I really want you to come on, Anand Krishnan. I'll get in touch with you. Let's bring you on to talk about. I know you've been writing about China-India border dispute, and we'd love to have you on. And we'll be joined, of course, by a couple of our regular guys. So thanks a lot, Will. Good to see you as always, and Jeremy as always.
Before we wrap up, I was just following the links from the top 10 newsmakers, and they link to a whole bunch of other top 10 stuff, among which is the top 10 business scandal. So like PR gold here. I just like to say.
Right. Okay. Make sure to check that out. Top 10 business scandals of 2010. On that note, before we do anything scandalous. Adios. We'll see you next week on Civic Podcast. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.